the reason for me to actually open source it from the beginning was to make it super easy for other teams in Finn to use it, because then it wasn't tied into some kind of legacy library or anything like that. It was, it could be taken into any code base and start using it.
Machines are so fast and stores are so big that they give us plenty of latitude to screw things up.
The shell, or which is the name we give to the command interpreter.
So the operator got a pair of tweezers and very carefully fished the moth out of the relay.
Because you've all read The Mythical Man Month.
And the best motivator in the world for programming is scratching your itch.
Developers, 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 developers.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Sourcecraft Podcast. My name is Byung, and on this show, we talk with the people behind amazing dev tools and developer experience. Open source authors, maintainers, DevEx engineers inside forward-thinking companies, developer advocates and educators, founders of dev tool companies, anyone and everyone who brings joy and delight into our lives as programmers. We talk about their work, we talk about their lives, we talk about their vision of what lies ahead for the world of code. Stay tuned. All right, everyone. Welcome back to another edition of the Sourcecraft Podcast. Today, I'm here with Egil and Ivar. They're two brothers who have created a popular open source feature flagging tool called Unleash. It has around 4,000 stars on GitHub. They've also started a company on top of this, which sells Unleash Enterprise for companies. And they're here today to talk about the backstory behind the open source project, the kind of journey of the company, and all the various considerations and details that go into feature flags for modern applications. So without further ado, Egil and Ivar, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, really happy to be here, Byung. Thanks for having us.
Awesome. So to kick things off, you know, before we get into Unleash and all the great work that you've done there, can you tell me how you both got into, you know, this business of computers and code in the first place?
Yeah, maybe I can start. I mean, it's the regular story. I picked up, or we picked up this Commodore 64 back ages ago. I think it was 1988 or something. I was 8 years old. And I was playing the games, but I found actually coding BASIC was more interesting. So I'm a bit ashamed to say so, but BASIC was actually my entry into the software development.
So I'm the little brother, so I was never allowed to use this Commodore 64. So I'm still a bit pissed about that. But for me, I actually started a bit later, to be honest. So we had the computers around, and Egil kind of introduced that to the family. But for me, it's really picked up when I started taking part in these data parties, is LAN, the parties that we did that I actually enjoyed hosting. I found it more interesting to host the party than to actually play the games, to set up the network and everything. So that's how I kind of got into it, I guess.
That's awesome. I think like BASIC and gaming are probably the two most popular things that I've heard from guests on the show of how they got into computers.
I can imagine. And actually we got another very old computer later, and I think we picked up, or I picked up, I think you was not allowed to use that one as well either. Fortran, which is another odd programming language, but it's sort of one programming language after the other, and eventually I figured out Ivar was much better than me doing development, and I was much better doing other stuff. So
cool.
I guess that's why we are still doing this together.
Yeah, that's awesome. So walk us through kind of the story from those beginnings to maybe like the beginnings of Unleash. You know, what's kind of the progression of your journey as programmers leading up to that point?
Yeah, if I take my I think at some point I figured out I was working at a company called Tanberg, acquired by Cisco, and I was fortunate to work with really skilled developers. I had this developer, he was actually, his core duty was to take the C programming language after it was compiled to whatever, assembly code or machine code, and optimize it even further. Huh. And at that point, I just understood that I'm never going to be at that level.
So he would hand optimize the outputted assembly? Wow.
Yeah. And of course, this was at the time where Zoom was not around. This was the first attempt to really make video conferencing run on an Intel processor. That was really really a tough challenge back in the days. Mm. But my core focus was sort of realizing I'm never going to be this good. I'm pretty good at other stuff. I'm pretty good at making other people shine and get good at what they are good at.
Yeah.
And I moved into more like management stuff. And luckily, we have guys like Ivar still around that actually knows how to do some proper coding.
Cool. Ivar, what about you? What's been your journey?
Yeah, so I started out from the university. I started out as a consultant, as you often do, for some reason. Yeah. I don't know. That's at least very common in Norway. I worked in the bank sector for a couple of years, bank and finance. And I found it a bit depressing, to be honest, because it was this, maybe you were allowed to release every month. It was like, it was just terrible working like this. Huh. And I started looking for other opportunities, and at some point I was lucky enough to start in this company called Finn.no, and we will talk a bit more about that later, I guess. And yeah. And there I've been on a very interesting journey, and people were much more kind of lean and agile and wanted to really make impact on the code I wrote and making sure that it actually solved a user need and getting it out there as soon as possible to the users.
Yeah.
So this was really an opportunity for me to learn a lot, to be honest. And in Finn, I have taken many, many different positions. I started out as a consultant, actually, but I soon realized that I just wanted to work there full time. So I switched and started out as a developer, and I kind of worked up the ranks. I started to become a tech lead, and then I started as an architect. And at some point, I also got the chief enterprise architect, leading the architect group for Finn.
Wow. And what is Finn for folks who are unfamiliar with it? Because it's like quite big in Norway, right? It's kind of like the Amazon in Norway.
Yeah, not quite. So
no,
it's
that's okay.
It's a marketplace. So it's a classified marketplace. So it started out by allowing people to put kind of ads online, selling new stuff. But it have kind of progressed into a lot of markets like jobs and real estate and all those kind of things. So it's the number one page in Norway, actually, owned by Schibsted, which owns a lot of classifieds in Europe and also other places in the world.
Cool. So yeah, I guess it would be more similar to Craigslist here in the US.
Okay. Exactly.
Got it.
But it's a prettier version of Craigslist, you may say.
Got it. So, I mean, I imagine it must be this quite complex code base with a lot
Absolutely.
Of features and a lot of scale.
Absolutely. And I was lucky enough to join at a time where it kind of went from this monthly release to start and think about how can we kind of improve on this? How can we move towards more release whenever we want? At some point, I felt like we have implemented all the things that are talked about in the DevOps handbook. It felt like we have done all the things. And we could release to production at any time. We have automated kind of all the deployment to all the environments.
Yeah.
And this was also at the time. So I was tech lead at the time. And this was actually the beginning of something like Unleash, because I was working as a tech lead in one of the teams there. And I felt like we had these weekly sprints. But still, we didn't push code into production every week, or we didn't release features to end customers every week. And this bugged me a lot. Why didn't we do that? So we had all these ideas, and every time, we can do that in a week. Of course we can. But suddenly you realize it's not possible because it's not fully tested. It's not all the way through. All the details is not there. And you don't want to put out poor quality to the users, of course.
Totally.
But still, it kind of bugged me because then we kind of postponed the learning. We postponed kind of the experience of actually putting code into a production environment, because there is all these small things that you don't think about. It could be edge cases. It could be just a firewall that has not been opened. It could be anything, actually. So I started kind of exploring. There has to be a solution to this. People have to have kind of encountered this before. And people had, of course, and there were already people talking about feature toggles. You had Martin Fowler, of course, and the famous blog article from him. And there were also kind of open source framework at the time, but they were typically a framework within your programming language. It was like for Java only, and you had to use this database.
Yeah.
And this kind of bugged me because we were already doing microservices. This was in 2014. We already had a polyglot programming model where we had some parts in Node.js, some part in Python, some part in Java. Yep. And I needed something, or at least I wanted something that could work across all of this and still be scalable. And it shouldn't be kind of this single point of failure that could take down everything.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought a bit about this problem, and I thought that there has to be ways to solve this. And this was actually before LaunchDarkly was a thing.
Got it.
So it was in 2004. At least it wasn't publicly known yet.
Yep.
And I kind of thought that this is something that I can solve. It seems like something I need, something so that I could change kind of the behavior of the code in production dynamically in a very performant way so that they wouldn't kind of hurt the performance of our applications. We were serving like 10K requests a second at peak. So I need to scale for that from the beginning. And I thought that it needed to be kind of this reverse dependency so that I could kind of put something in the application that would do the evaluation, but I wanted the rules to be centralized so that I had the configuration centralized. It was pushed down to the applications.
Yep.
And the application could themselves decide whether a feature should be enabled or disabled for a particular user.
Got it. So you had a kind of like you wanted a single dashboard where you could toggle these things on and off and change the behavior of the application without having to push code or make changes.
Exactly.
Got it. And I find, you know, you touched upon this a little bit earlier about the importance of feature flagging to engineering velocity. I think it becomes a lot more important, especially as you scale, because there's more and more quality considerations that you want to make sure that you meet before you release something to like general availability, right? But then that very same QA enforcement mechanism becomes a kind of blocker. Like it can kill a lot of good ideas before they're able to gain traction or prove themselves.
Exactly. And I see this all the time. And you have one extra dimension today, and that's the privacy part, because you cannot usually just have all the data you have in production available in a testing environment. You can, of course, have synthetic data that are similar, but it's not the same.
Yeah, totally. So what was kind of the V1 of what you built, this feature flagging tool for internal use at Finn?
So V1 was a very simplistic version, I would say. You could turn things on and off. You could enable it for a specific user, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just adding functionality from there, I guess.
Got it. And so it kind of evolved over time. At what point did you open source it?
It was open source quite early. So I developed this, or together with some others, we developed it in late autumn 2014. And it was officially open sourced January 2015. But it was actually... The repo was created in 2014, but we didn't push the code out before for January 2015.
Got it. And what was the process around like open sourcing? Did you have to get organizational buy-in, you know, agreement from stakeholders inside the company to open source it, or was it, you know, relatively straightforward?
I would say it was quite straightforward, and it was actually a kind of an internal push in the company also that we wanted, or the Finn wanted, to kind of show more of what they were doing to the world and share more with the world, because Finn is also using a lot of open source, so why shouldn't Finn also contribute stuff back?
Yeah.
So that was kind of the philosophy back then, and still is, I believe.
Yeah. And so when you open sourced it, what was the initial reaction? Like, did other people start using it immediately? Did it take a while for it to catch on?
Yeah, I think it's like with every good thing, it takes a bit time for people to discover it. And I haven't, at least for many years, I didn't do any kind of official commercializing or announcement marketing or anything like that. I just open sourced it, and And yep. the reason for me to actually open source it from the beginning was to make it super easy for other teams in Finn to use it, because then it wasn't tied into some kind of legacy shared library or anything like that. It was it could be taken into any code base and start using it. And so how it grew was actually, this is how I kind of observed it. It started growing within Finn. It was never it was never a push to actually use it. It was more like people were using it, and they used it also when they're doing the show-offs. They're showing new functionality, they used Unleash on the stage to show, we enable it for 10% of the users, stuff like that.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then it started growing organically within Finn. But what I also kind of noticed was that when developers quit Finn, one of the first thing they did in the new company was to introduce Unleash.
That's awesome. So you basically didn't do any sort of like selling or pitching or trying to get people to use it. You just released it, made it open source, and then over time it kind of spread organically through word of mouth and people leaving Finn and taking it with them.
Yeah, and of course I have been invited to conferences to talk about it. I have done that, but that was kind of later years. So in the beginning, I didn't do anything like that. Of course, in hindsight, I should have, but I didn't.
Yeah. What was the first point at which you said, like, wow, like this thing is actually being used by a lot of people? Like, there are a lot of people relying on this.
Yeah, I started seeing that a number of stars on GitHub started growing quite rapidly in late 2018.
And
I was actually, this is interesting, and also people started sending me emails personally, like, could you just host this for us, we could pay you for it. It was like that, and that's a sign, I guess. So this was when I started talking to Egil about this, because I had actually never mentioned this to Egil. I just it was a side project. I found it like a fun problem to work on by night and evenings. Yeah. But it wasn't like I had never intention of making more of it than that at the time, at least. And then at some, like brothers do, we sometimes go out, have some beer, some food.
Yeah.
And I just started talking about this project, and I said to Egil, like, I don't know what to do about this. What do you think?
Yeah, I remember actually. It's actually not true, because I think you mentioned this to me back in 2016. At the time, I didn't really grasp what it was doing, to be honest, and to be fair. But it sort of stuck with me for some time that this was sort of possible. And I remember very well that evening. And the interesting part, we discussed this, of course, in more depth on what is it it's doing, what is it capable of handling. And as you understand that you get there, Bijang, that Eva was coming from this environment that was super on the edge with the DevOps, with the microservices. At the time, I would say working at a company, software company, it's a very successful, but it's more like an M&A company called Visma back in Europe.
Got it.
And my duty, I was often put into an organization that was sort of, they were doing legacy development, legacy engineering. The code base was not necessarily the most, I would say, on the edge.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, I saw that this was actually solving a lot of my problems. Because as you say, and as you mentioned, this kind of Q&A process, with or without the data, just the fact that you're trying to replicate a very advanced QA test or pre-production environment,
it's
like super costly. It takes you a lot of resources, a lot of time, a lot of manpower to try to get it. And usually you don't really get it. And you still, at least those companies I was, or some of those I was part of, was still having issues in production at the time. Still launching a lot of new updates with tons of challenges. And the time we spent just fixing up in production issues was like ridiculous. And having this idea of being able to kind of control everything in production at customer site, which was also the case in this company.
Yeah.
Was really intriguing, and as Eva says, the fact that people are asking to kind of get this product and pay for it is like this obvious thing. We just need to get something done here and start seeing what we can make out of this.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you kind of, at that point, it kind of clicked for you, given your experience with your existing company. What was the process of, like, was there a point when the both of you finally said like, okay, let's do it. Like, let's actually like start a company around this.
So if I may, I think it was sort of an evolving process for the both of us. Obviously we were both having interesting jobs, well paid opportunities.
Yep.
And frankly, it was sort of, it was a giant leap to kind of leave that safety and move into something else. So what we decided to do was, as the developer, as an engineer, do this iterative, stating, let's do the simplest go to market and product kind of wrapping we can do of this.
Yeah.
And just start learning. Obviously I started to do some market analysis, looking at who are the competitors, where is this possible positioning, and it was a very steep learning curve, to be honest. It was very interesting, but we decided at the time to keep it as a side gig. I think we made a promise that we were never going to put any feature into the product because of a customer deal. I think we actually broke that promise. But we really wanted to just say, this is the product and see if there is anyone willing to pay for it. And actually that was the case. I think we launched the last version of our webpage in April or May, maybe it was 1st of May.
Yeah.
And I think we had the first signed up customer sometime in June. So it was, pretty,
that was quick.
That was pretty quick. It was amazing. And most of the first customer is still with us, so I'm really, really happy with that.
Yeah, that's awesome. So is the paid version of the product, is it essentially Unleash, the open source thing, running hosted, like someone else is hosted? Is there any other like difference or distinction that you make between the two versions?
Yeah, there is a couple of things. So what we do is we do an open core model. So we actually extend Unleash open source with more functionality. So we are actually using the open source and adding more in the enterprise. Most of it is around user management, role-based access control, group stuff into projects and have access control on those projects and stuff like that. So it's more like convenience for enterprises to kind of manage access to who can do what. But we also add some functionality or more advanced targeting rules to the Pro edition or the Commercial edition, and making it even more convenient for the companies to do or control their rollout without having to write any code to do that, so that they can define different rule segments that they want to target with the new feature.
Yeah, that makes sense. This is a common pattern, I think. Sourcegraph follows the same open core model where there's a core that's open source. It provides, I think, most of the functionality, especially if you're an individual developer. But then there's these additional features that are enterprise specific that you kind of build into the paid for product. And
yeah, and it's super hard, I must say. Maybe you have experienced the same thing, but it's super hard. Where does the line go? And we try to be kind of as transparent as we can. And so far we have only, and I think we will try to stick to this as long as we can, we have only kind of moved functionality from the paid version into the open source. We have so far never done the other way, and I hope we'll never get there. So our plan is to kind of the best functionality, the newest kind of the best stuff, the most shiny stuff will come into the commercial version, and if we see that this is not kind of a differentiator or this could be really useful for a lot of people, we will actually move it to the open source. An example of this is that we added kind of more or easier control for your API, so that you can add API tokens and so forth also in the open source. It makes sense. It doesn't make sense to kind of require you to write some custom code to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think this open core model that you described that you guys do as well, it makes total sense. I mean, it's really important that you have something for the individual developer that really is providing a lot of value. Because I don't think you will get away with just throwing out some open source kind of software out there that doesn't really make sense. It needs to provide some proper value.
Yeah.
And of course, as Eva says, this is the interesting, challenging beauty of it. Where do you put the line? And I think that is also where we are iterating and learning every day.
Yeah, 100%. It's a tough line to draw. A lot of times it feels like you're trading off like building something awesome that every developer can use and, you know, growing awareness as much as you can versus, you know, capturing some of that value to keep the lights on and keep growing as a business.
Yeah, I think maybe if I may share this, Eva, I think that this decision to open source the native apps SDKs was probably one of the toughest one we had. I would say it, to me, it felt like I know we have closed some business because of this, and taking care of the commercial aspects of everything. It was Eva was really clear, and he's absolutely right. This is something that makes total sense to the individual developers. So we need to be true to what we're saying. But I need to admit, I met myself. I'm not sure if that is an English expression. I met myself in the door and saying like, okay, I need to listen to this, but I don't like it. And but we did. So I think back in May we open sourced also the full native SDKs with our Unleash proxy, and it seems to be picking up quite well.
That's awesome. Way to go, Ivar, for making that the case for that, and Egil for understanding where that was coming from. I think we have a lot of the same discussions internally at Sourcegraph too between various stakeholders.
I can imagine it's a very tough and I can imagine as more as you grow as a business as well, as more focused you are on the top line and revenue.
Yeah.
This conversation. So for us, it has actually been a very cautious decision to make this kind of commercial versus the open source from the day one, because it is difficult. It has to be difficult.
Yeah.
And I truly believe that this is going to be why we are successful, because we are building this culture for really understanding where is the line that needs to be kind of in the doors, in the walls, in the wood of the office spaces, that we really notice. Everybody just knows that this is the decision. Everybody adapts to that and we move forward.
Yeah.
So we are training that every day, and it's hard, but it's necessary.
Yeah, totally. Can we dive a bit into like all the stuff that falls under this umbrella of feature flagging? Because I imagine folks listening, they probably span the gamut from like, you know, oh, feature flag, that's just a Boolean variable that you can toggle on and off that turns, you know, some minor part of your application on or off. But there is actually like a huge like range and depth to the things that you can do with this tool. Can you talk about some of the more like interesting involved use cases?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is a lot of things, and of course Booleans on and off for everyone is the easiest one and the most obvious one. If you take that one step further, a very common use case is that you want to enable it for a percentage of users. And one of the things that you have to consider then is how to make sure that it's a consistent behavior for an individual user, and still you are not kind of showing or treating the 1% the same across all your features. That could also be bad, or maybe you want that. That's kind of the configuration that you need to do. Maybe you want two feature targets to actually target the same users.
Yep.
But this starts to add complexity when you're starting thinking about it, and maybe you want to throw in that you suddenly think that you don't want to do 1% for everyone. Maybe you just want to do 1% for your gold customers or 1% of the customers in Norway, for that matter. And when you start adding all these small things, all these attributes that need, you start building up complex rules that could be hard to kind of get right. And we also need to make sure that we do this right across all our implementations. So we have SDKs for all the kind of popular languages, at least official SDKs. There is also a huge list of more community supported SDKs.
Yeah.
And we also make sure that we do this correct or the same way across all these implementations. So we do a hashing algorithm to make sure that that all the SDKs are using the same hashing algorithm, making sure that when we say 1% of the users, we mean the same 1% of the users in the Go client SDK or in the Java SDK.
Yeah,
and remember that the rules are evaluated in the application and not in the server API. So we need to actually make sure that the SDK does it correctly. So to do this, we also have created a client specification framework so that we can use that to drive our integration test for all the SDKs to make sure that they evaluate the rules the same way.
Yeah, makes sense. And I'm sure there's a ton of interesting tech there that I want to dive into in a little bit. But before we get into that, Egil, you mentioned, you know, doing some sort of competitive analysis, you know, at the very get-go. And I think a lot of people are probably trying to triangulate where Unleash stands with respect to other feature flagging tools out there, like, you know, LaunchDarkly or Split or other tools. Can you talk a little bit about what sets Unleash apart, or why, you know, your customers decide to use you over other options?
Sure. Absolutely. And it's a great question. And as you mentioned there, this is a category that is growing. It's definitely an area where there is getting a lot of attention at the moment. So obviously LaunchDarkly, looking at the funding and I believe also revenue, is the biggest player on the ground. So they have been around about the same as long as we have been around as an open source project, interestingly enough, but they have been like more visible and more loud out there.
Yeah.
And I think that the biggest, of course, the most obvious one, we are open source and most of the other competitors are not. I wouldn't say that is not necessarily a differentiator. It gives us some advantages for sure. I mean, just the fact that people are able to really dive into the source code, they are able to see what is happening. They are really getting this pulse of, is this something that happens in this tool or not? Quite a few customers or let's say lead developers coming back and saying, this is, we have looked at your open source repo. There is a lot of activity. We like that. We also see that there is contributors to this. So this is something we believe in.
Yeah.
And I also believe it provides quite a high level of, let's say, trust, because we know that every developer are able to inspect the code. So I trust the developer teams and email to really be top notch, and they are. The feedback so far is that this is really, really rock solid. And actually, a true story: we were talking to another some friends of us out of Sweden, CodeCentric, I believe they are called. There is doing technical debt management and code inspection, and the CTO of the company was investigating our source code, our open source code, and because he wanted to identify some tech debt, and he came back and said, well, this is not interesting. This is just too good. So I think this is a good, valid feedback that there is some reasonable strength in the code. And obviously also we see that from the stability where we don't really see any issues with that. So, but compared to LaunchDarkly and Split, I think that the biggest advantage we have is our extreme versatile or flexible platform. Obviously we have a lot of the same design decisions, the API first, everything is an API. Everything is possible in or out of our core API, which makes it really attractive and adaptable to any platform teams. And I see more and more large organizations do have this developer efficiency team or internal platform team, or there is many, many, many names for the same kind of responsibility, making sure that there is proper tooling and like a developer platform available to the product team. So I see that talking to these guys, Unleash is really a perfect match. We can basically adapt to anything. And part of the adaptability is also, it's super easy for us to deploy to anywhere. I mean, private clouds, even on-prem is something that for some customer makes a tons of sense. Yeah. Or of course, go with our hosting. And as Eos says, privacy has been a very focused from the day one. And I see that the focus of privacy is increasing, in particular in Europe. There is a lot of tension around privacy all over the world at the moment. I think there was last week or the week before, there was a long article around this REMS 2 verdict was really going in maybe we can say an extreme part of the GDPR, but it was really putting extra responsibility and awareness, I would say, about data privacy. And we see the same out of Australia. We see the same out of the California Act. And we see the same out of, I think, is quite a bit of the Latin as well. So privacy concern is probably one of those where it's really hard to compete. But of course, that is a trade-off. We need to trade something off for that. So what is sure is that data will never flow from our SDKs into our platform. That is really something we take really serious.
Yeah.
And in the healthcare, in the financial sector, in a lot of those heavily regulated industries, this is really makes a tons of difference.
Yeah, makes sense. So with respect to the privacy question, the advantage of Unleash here is that you can run the server side of the feature flagging tool on your own infrastructure, like within your own organization. It doesn't go to a third party.
If you want to go all the way to kind of the extreme situation where everything is under your control, you can take everything back home.
But even
if you want to stay and consuming cloud operations or cloud business like the host version, it's still we have designed the protocol to never share any PII back from SDK back to our server side. So we allow you to configure the rules and you have a ton of flexibility on this advanced segmentation that you was talking about.
Yeah.
But everything happens server side in your application, part of the application, and you take care of your privacy. You should not have an extra layer of complexity because you're adding a wonderful tool like Unleash into your product.
Got it. So even if I'm using your hosted version, there's kind of special things that you built in to obfuscate or anonymize the data that you're
collecting. It's never shared. So
got it.
It's built into the application.
Cool.
Yeah.
You touched upon developer experience as a thing that you like to emphasize as well. Can you talk about what is the developer experience like of using something like Unleash? Like, how would I interact with it as a developer?
Usually, you would use the SDK, of course, and we have emphasized a lot on also minimized or make the SDKs very lightweight. This is something developer really fancy. And for instance, the Java SDK, we only add kind of one dependency, and that's JSON parsing because that's hard in Java. Besides from that, we are only using core libraries. Even though it makes our job a bit harder because it's harder to do HTTP and all of that.
So the SDK is the thing that you embed in the client, and then the server side is something that's running elsewhere, and the SDK will talk to the server to determine like which flags are on and how should I affect the behavior of the application.
Yes, it will synchronize with the server in the background. And also that part is very optimized. That's different per SDK, of course, per platform. In the Java SDK, we will actually only use a single thread in the background to do all the communication with the Unleash API, just to minimize our kind of resource consumption on your application. And this is all those kind of small details that are super important to be appealing to developers. You also have the APIs, of course, where you can do anything you can do in the management UI. You can do also from the API. This is also something we have a lot of plans on improving, making it even easier to do patches and stuff like that, so that you can kind of update just what you actually want to update and not send longer payloads. So we have a lot of plans on even improving the APIs to make it even simpler. But you also will interact with the management UI to kind of define your feature toggle. Actually, you don't have to actually manually define it, because if you start using a feature toggle in the SDK, it will actually detect it and it will prompt you to actually create that feature toggle in the management UI if you haven't already.
Oh, that's cool.
Because we will send usage metrics back to the API so that we know which apps are connected, how many instances are they connected from, and which feature toggles do they actually consume.
Interesting.
So we will collect all that user data, and from that we can make it easier to understand, is this feature toggle actually being used? Where is it being used? How often is it used in the last hour? Stuff like that. Because the other part of this is the technical depth side of things. This is also a huge problem with feature toggles. So you're trading away kind of the long-running feature branches that are never merged back to master because it's hard. And then you have the feature toggles instead, which actually are feature branches inside your code, giving a lot of power. But then you have all this different code paths in your application. For some reason, it seems like people are clean up afterwards. A lot of developers are moving on, their focus to new features. It seems like it's nice to just leave those feature toggles around. This bugs me a lot, and I think we, as a kind of as a tool provider, we should also address this issue, because the amount of feature toggles is not the point in itself.
Yeah, and I think actually that is a very important point. We have seen some of the competitors, I don't need to name them, has been sort of referring to the number of feature toggles being served in the platform, which I understand is from a marketing point of view, it makes tons of sense because it kind of gives you this impression of scale. It's big. It's kind of really massive. Mm-hmm. Sure it is. But also it kind of gives you, if you start thinking about it, it gives you incentive to kind of keep that feature toggle in there, because that is part of what you're, how you, a North Star metric for a company, which from engineering point of view, doesn't make sense at all. So actually this tech debt management was something we decided to build into this platform from the day one, because as you mentioned, coming back to the developer experience, it's really, or at least my experience working with developers and developer organization, technical debt or kind of anything that doesn't really meet like this sales guy's requirement for the next nice to have feature is really hard to get into the roadmap or into the sprint. And by providing some visibility, to provide some kind of dashboard or reporting telling that there is actually something that you should do here with your whatever, and in our case, that's the cleaning up your feature toggles, it's really valuable, because it's usually not because we want to point fingers. It's more like opening up a conversation between the product manager or the marketing guys or whoever is saying that, we have done it, but we haven't finished. We really need to clean up, because otherwise we will impact our velocity, and nobody really wants that. Everybody wants the next feature to be shipped as quick as possible. And we want to make it a bit easier for all of the tech leads to kind of take that conversation and like highlight that there is something that we need to do here.
Go ahead.
And interesting enough, when we built this functionality, we were also provided access to a lot of open source users and their kind of data on their usage to perform a larger analysis. So we actually analyzed the usage across more than 100 applications using Unleash. And we saw that 50% of the feature toggles were kind of being used for 50 days. And after that, they were kind of, they have served their purpose. They were never changed anymore. They were usually just staying around. And some people turned them off or deleted them or deactivated them, but most just kept them around.
And so, that's all like tech debt. That's like a dead code path that could, you know, shoot your team in the foot down the road. It's probably untested,
nasty,
right?
Nasty stories out there, and we don't want to put our customers in that position, obviously.
And of course, there are some valid use cases. You have the kill switches, for instance, that could be super convenient when you need them, but then you should actually invert them. You should actually have them default to disabled, and you can enable them when you need them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Can you talk a bit about like the people, both like the paying customers and also the open source projects that are using you currently?
Yeah, there is like it's a wide range. I mean, every business today is looking for developer efficiency one way or the other.
Yeah.
So I think that what we are seeing here is that there is, I think we have customer in all sectors at the moment, in most, all of the continents, obviously. And I think that what we are seeing is more on the engineering maturity rather than kind of an industry specific. Obviously, some industries is always a step ahead. And I'm sad to say you guys in the US tend to be slightly ahead of the Europe and Asia on the engineering culture. So we are picking up speed, but you're still a head or two in front of us there. But it's usually there is the customer is either already in the DevOps space. They are already set. They are kind of just looking for a tool to kind of go into the pipeline, or mm-hmm. they are, which we see is a bit more a tougher sale. They want to do it. And for one reason or the other, they it's difficult. And I would say that actually developer efficiency is something that really puts into being a business problem. And sadly, we see that there is often this initiative is driven by engineering and quite a bit of time that also leads to that kind of the business part is saying, well, we don't want to spend either time or money on this now. It sounds like a nice thing to have, but we don't have time to do this. So I think most of your listeners can recognize this one way or the other.
Yeah, totally. What are some of the big open source projects that use Unleash?
That's a good question. Actually, one of the in the public sector, you have something called NAV, which is the Norwegian Labor Authorities. They have open sourced a lot of their code, so it's not kind of properly open source projects, I would say, but they have open sourced their code. And they use Unleash a lot, actually, and they use the Unleash open source edition. So that's kind of the biggest one that I know about, at least. And they have like open sourced more than 100 applications, I think, that use Unleash. So that's quite interesting to look into, actually. Besides from that, I'm a bit unsure. I think some of our customers are doing open core. But I haven't kind of prepared that list for you, so I'm a bit unsure, to be honest.
Yeah, no worries. That's cool. Do you have an idea of like how many applications use Unleash at the moment? Like, what is the kind of scale of the impact that you're having?
Yeah, so we are tracking downloads of the Docker image. So we know that the Docker image or the pools, it's more than 6,000 pulls each day at the moment. That's the current rate of the Docker image, and it's growing quite nicely, actually, and 4.2 million downloads or pull requests in total so far. In addition, we are tracking, so we have some callback functionality to check the version and stuff like that, and we know that there, but that was added quite recently in April. I mean, as you probably also know, is that open source tend to be more like long-term support. So it's not everyone is not updating all the time. So we see that it takes some time for customer or users of the open source to actually update. But we are tracking, or we have seen more than 30,000 installations in total, but they are not all active. So we have a hunch that it's a couple of thousand active installation based on the numbers we see.
And also you sort of are paying attention to, as soon as you put something out there, a new version, the download rate is quite quite well.
It's almost I'm almost afraid, because people are pulling down and installing the new version before I do. It's like crazy.
That's awesome.
So it should be high quality every time we release
a new version. It is high quality, Ivar.
It must be.
So, you know, another side of this, in addition to the user community, is given that you're open source, is also the contributor community. Can you talk about like the open source contributions that have been made to Unleash as a feature flagging platform and what impact they've had on the capabilities of the product?
Yeah, we have a couple of interesting contributions. Of course, the most kind of popular place to contribute is on the SDK side. So we have a lot of community developed SDKs, and they tend to pop up every now and then for a new programming language that is out. We have a community SDK for Rust or for Elixir and stuff like that, which is just awesome that people do that. So that's really interesting. But also on the Unleash project, we also have contributions like, for instance, the import export type of API, where you can kind of jump to your full state and export that, and you can import that into a new running instance of Unleash. that was fully contributed. The first version of that was contributed by an external contributor, and it has proven to be very valuable to us as well. At least when people want to convert from the open source into a hosted offering, it's super convenient to have that functionality in place.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I also remember when we put up this team around this commercial offering, I think one of the most interesting stories was, I think it was Christopher on a team, he was like stars in his eyes. He was coming to the stand-up and was saying, it's fantastic working for an open source company because I'm writing this code and I'm getting feedback as I write the code before I even launch the feature by the community. Yeah. So he was engaging with some of the community members and they were kind of highlighting some, I'm sure it was some improvement points they've found in his source code. And I mean, the feedback cycle, I never seen anything like it. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
But I think it's safe to say that we have a very good user community and we have a very engaging community on Slack where people ask questions, they get answered and stuff like that. But I would say that the contributor community, it's of course, it could be better. It's like, yes, we have a lot of contributors. We get contributions every week, but it's usually more towards kind of creating integrations for other solutions, creating SDKs. Right. And these are very valuable, but they don't drive the product by themselves.
Right.
And of course, that's a good thing also, because we are doing this full time and relying on the community could also actually slow us down. So I think it's a balancing act there.
Yeah, I think it makes a ton of sense to open up and make it super easy for the community to contribute in across to kind of value adds on top of the product. But we need to take care of the quality of the core. Obviously, always welcoming anyone that want to contribute or kind of improvement suggesting and these kind of things. But by the end of the day, it's our responsibility and our name on and heads on the block to make sure it has the top notch quality that is. It has to be. And So the cross and the value adds and one of the nice thing we haven't really started to market that is we put up this add-on platform, so it's super easy to create this pre-curated add-ons to any kind of third party. So we see that this is popping up. I think it takes with a couple of days if we are requesting from suggesting from the community that we should have this kind of add-on for one or the other.
What sort of add-ons are these, like add-ons for specific languages?
It would be to integrate with other solutions. For instance, we requested a Datadog add-on. It was nice to have, but we didn't use Datadog ourselves. So we requested, we just created the issue and said that this was a good first issue. And it took a couple of weeks and then suddenly someone jumped on it and they used a few days and created an add-on to Datadog so that you can see in Datadog, you can actually get the event log from Unleash and see if a feature toggle changes. You will see that in your Datadog graph so that you can correlate that if something suddenly starts to fail.
That's cool.
Similar with Microsoft Teams, Slack, stuff like that.
Yeah. It's really tough to strike the right balance between getting community contributions, especially to that core part of the code base that maybe is a little bit more difficult to dive into just because it's, you know, there's a lot going on and it's kind of not adjacent to anything that an external user would know. It's not the SDK, right? It's the standalone service. And that's something that we struggle with a lot too, because on the one hand, you want to encourage contributions. I think there's a lot of knowledge out there that people can contribute to that part of the application that you might, you wouldn't think of yourself. But at the same time, like not having that deep context into that code base makes it difficult to check all the quality boxes to make a contribution.
Exactly.
Yeah, and we've actually been thinking a little bit about this at Sourcegraph, where there's a feature idea that popped up, and maybe we should like feature flag this using Unleash to create like a almost like a notebook view where you can kind of write out like, here's how I would onboard to this part of the code or something like that, just to make it easier. Like an expert could write up this like tour of that part of the code, and you could hand that to beginners. Anyways, now I'm kind of venturing off into t- talking about SourceGraph, but
makes a ton of sense.
It's a very
You are actually touching upon it, and how can you kind of encapsulate parts where it will make sense for multiple parties to actually contribute code without them having to understand everything.
And you almost do some of that by defining maybe like strong API boundaries, because with things like the add-on ecosystem, we have like our own extension ecosystem. If you have like a very firm, clear API boundary, then you can kind of divide and conquer a little bit and say like, okay, you know, this part, we're going to have like these rules, these norms for this part of the code base, and that's separated from this other part. And so we don't have to worry as much about the code becoming like a spaghetti piled mess, because it's kind of like isolated and contained. Anyways.
Yeah, makes sense. Cool. And we are seeing exactly the same thing. As Eva says, we need to kind of make it very easy and isolated and self-contained as an issue. Makes it much easier to get onboarded. And also, if you can get this repeatable, and that's why we decided to build this add-on framework, it's one pattern, it's one way of working, and it's sort of one part of the documentation there to onboard our community to start creating this.
Yeah, cool. From the technical side, what are some of the more interesting like technical challenges that you've had to solve to enable feature flagging at large scale and across languages?
I think you already said it there. I think at least in the beginning, the hardest part was, of course, to add support for more programming languages. And because we decided to put the logic inside SDK itself, the evaluation of the rules. And I cannot be an expert in all the programming languages out there. I'm not that smart, luckily. Or sadly, I don't know.
I'm not sure about that.
but that's a good thing. So I can kind of, and my strong point is that I know quite well a lot of Java. I know a lot of Node, and they're quite different as a programming languages. They're quite different approaches. And for me to kind of think about this problem and actually implement a solution in both of those makes it more likely that it would be possible for someone to implement this in Python or in Go or any of the other programming languages. And it has proven to be quite a good model. It's like, and now we are not always implementing in Java or Node first. We are actually, if someone comes to us, they have something they want to solve, and they are using, for instance, the Go SDK, we might implement the new functionality only in the Go SDK and add it behind some flags for the unleash part to make sure that we can test it and verify it. And if it turns out that this is a good idea, we start moving on and implementing it into more of the SDKs. And then we announce it that this is actually a functionality that you can now take advantage of from some version of the SDKs. And this has been challenging, but luckily I have gotten a lot of help from the community on the SDK side, and we still actually closely work with some of the maintainers of some of the SDKs because they are good guys and they actually want us to succeed and they want to help out, and we take some responsibility in actually implementing new functionality, but they will step up, they will help us code review the pull request and make sure that we do it the right way in the various programming languages, and it has been just very helpful to have them around, to be honest.
I think you mentioned consistent hashing across languages as like a challenge earlier too. Like, what can you talk a little bit about that? Like, why has that been a challenge?
So I started out not thinking that we need, or I didn't realize that there was a problem in the first version. So I just kind of did some regular object hashing in Java, and I found some other hashing for Node, and it worked. But then I realized that it was a problem because the user might enter to different parts of your stack, and you might use the same feature toggle in multiple places in various programming languages. And suddenly if the same user would get it, like in the Node application, they would get false, and in the Java application, they would get true. And it would be confusing, or it could be confusing. And suddenly you have an unpredictable kind of experience for that user. So then I started thinking there has to be a better way, and we needed to find some way of solving this so that it was consistent. And I already had hashing was kind of very natural to me to do that, to just do the randomization. But I started investigating, so what do others do again? And it turned out that most of the A-B testing tools seems to have kind of standardized around something called murmur hash. It's known for having a very good random property and to be very fast. So it's not secure, but we didn't need that. We just need some easy way to randomize a number between 0 and 100 and do it the same way across different programming languages. And it already is a very small kind of hashing algorithm, so there are already implementations in all the languages. So it was easy to just use that, basically. And that was, I wouldn't say it was very challenging, like in terms of code you had to write. It was more like figuring out how to do it correctly. Other parts that has been challenging, I think lately I have been struggling a bit with, we are doing a lot of heavy lifting inside Unleash itself, where we do a lot of changes, but it's super important to me to be backward compatible. We should not break users' applications, and at least not in the first major version. So we need to make sure that we support our APIs, we support at least our SDKs for a long time. And it's a long time since I last broke the SDK API, because I don't think we should do that ever, or at least that's my goal. Because it could be very unpredictable, and you cannot expect customers or users to just update their SDK all the time to make sure that they are on the latest, greatest, and know which version they need to use to be very compatible. Of course, that requires us to think a lot and have a lot of unit tests and integration tests to make sure that we don't break stuff. And it also makes it harder to introduce new concepts. But I think it's important, though. So I see now that if I just have thought about all the things we're going to build, it would be so much easier just to build it from scratch.
That's another balance that's so hard to get right. Because backcompat is so important, especially when people start using your thing in production. But at the same time, it can become this kind of restrictive constraint around new innovation. I guess that's why, like, some people just do the version 1, version 2, like version break.
You can do that, and actually we did that once, but we added it to the payload itself and not as a part of the URL. That was for the SDK part. It worked okay. So I think the smartest thing that we did, and it's looked a bit stupid for a couple of years. So I decided at one point that the SDK API should be a different API than the admin API, where you actually do the mutations. And in the beginning, they were exactly the same. It was the same payload. It was like the client SDK could only support GET, but from the admin API, you could also do POST and mutated data. And it was felt like it quite stupid in the beginning. But lately, it has been paying out quite well, because now we can do a lot of larger changes on how you work with feature toggles, but we can still map that back to have a very consistent API for the SDKs.
Got it. So you separated out the two APIs so that you could kind of have different rules and different constraints for each.
And you can scale it differently. You can add more caching maybe to the client SDKs and make sure that they perform in a different scale, basically. Yeah.
So what does the road ahead hold for Unleash, both the open source project and the company?
So, of course, it's world domination. Everyone should use Unleash, and Unleash runs everywhere. But we have a lot of ideas to get there. and there is a lot of things that we focus on. One of the things that is really important to us, and we want to kind of solve real problems. So we actually have a head of customer journey as part of the core team, and we are interviewing both open source users. We are interviewing customers, and we do that regularly. And we have done that for a lot in Q2 to kind of prepare for a lot of improvements in Q3 on how we onboard new users. We want to make So we have this idea that the first moment of wow, that this is the first time you actually understand the value of a tool like Unleash. And yeah. We want to make sure that you get that moment the first time you try Unleash, and not the second time or after talking to someone else that discovered it after a few months of hacking. So we want that to be kind of in the first session where you actually interact with Unleash.
Yeah, and I think what you say there, Ivar, interviewing and getting user feedback is, I would say we are very obsessed with that. Obviously, we have a direction where we want to go. We have quite clear thoughts on what is, where is the feature flag space going. I mean, feature flags or feature titles to me is like commodity. It's you need to provide something else. You need to provide some value on top of that, because it's sort of, I mean, we understand that this is our system complexity that is interesting to solve. But it's also something that, I mean, with all of the players in the market today, it's going to be commoditized. So we are very much focused on this, understanding these pain points. And I mean, I think we have as much customer interviews as we have customer sales conversation. I mean, it's really getting to understand the pains, really understanding the situation, really understanding how there is any kind of friction point that we can support or take away or even turn around as a competitive advantage there. On the business side, we are stepping up quite a bit on the commercial side. We just brought our head of sales onto the team, based out of New York. So we are very excited to have the feet on the ground already in the US. Cool. And also this means that we are stepping up on all of those kind of what we expect to see on the customer success or getting the product properly supported into the organizations. And also we are looking into where can we fit into supporting our customers making developer efficient, either through partnerships or through integrations, or make it super easy for them to make Unleash part of their work platform or the development platform. And I think also, I think there is two big North Stars. I mean, Ival, you have this, or at least you come back again and again to this kind of phrase. You want to make sure that the world is unleashing new features. So that is sort of the North Star. We really want everybody to have access to unleashing new features to the production, because that's a huge difference. And I was and the second part I was actually coming to, I just forgot now. Sorry.
No worries. Yeah.
And also to add to this, of course, because we are open source, we also have an open source or open public roadmap. So if you're interested in what we are working on right now or for the next kind of quarter, you will find that on GitHub as a project on GitHub under the Unleash repo.
Cool.
So we are open on everything we do. That's not kind of, this is what we focus on right now and what our kind of immediate plans are. Obviously, we also do a lot of other things than just what's on the roadmap. But that's at least for us to be transparent, and we will always adapt that roadmap into new learnings and what customer tells us and what the customer interviews and user interviews tells us.
Yeah, and I was just the idea came back to me there, and so part of making this, everybody should have access to unleashing a new feature. We are also see that we need to take this space from feature configuration into purpose-driven feature management. Feature configuration doesn't make sense. It's just a step on the way to really start doing proper purpose-driven feature management.
What is the difference between feature configuration?
Configuration is where you have your tech lead, your architect, your product owner, your product manager, whoever really, they start saying, okay, who should have access to this feature? Where do I need to enable this? For whom and when and when and these kind of things. So what you really should think about is, so by adding this feature, what am I trying to achieve? Do I try to achieve like a performance improvement? Do I try to achieve conversion rate that is better? Am I doing an A/B test maybe? And if so, what are the metrics, the key metrics in your business that you're trying to change there? And actually, we did some super interesting project together with Kevin, the open source project. I think it's supported by Dynatrace, where we we started to explore this as a proof of concept, like how can you start creating self-healing application, meaning you do you enable a feature and you see that some of the predefined metrics or metrics that you have in your operation dashboard starts to be badly impacted. Can you correlate that feature release into this this kind of impact on your metrics? And if so, where is the bar for disabling this feature and kind of go back to the team and say, well, we need to do something here because it doesn't really work exactly as we say. So to me, that is a huge difference. And I see the space we have, there is so much talk about configuration. And I mean, nobody really likes configuration, right?
Yeah, it's kind of got a boring, a slightly negative connotation.
Exactly.
As kind of a final parting thought, you know, if people are listening to this and they want to get started with Unleash, where should they go?
getunleash.io. That's the starting point. You find everything from the documentation of open source. You find the links to where to download open source. And if they want to get in touch with us, there is also opportunities to reach out to our sales team and set up an appointment or just request access to our paid offering. Hosted paid offering.
Awesome. Well, Egil and Ivar, thank you so much for joining us today. This was an awesome conversation.
It was a pleasure being here. I really enjoyed being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
The Sourcegraph podcast is a production of Sourcegraph, the universal code search engine, which gives you fast and expressive search over the world of code you care about. Sourcegraph also provides code navigation abilities like jump to dev and references in code review and integrates seamlessly with your code host, whether you're working in open source or on a big, hairy enterprise code base. To learn more, visit sourcegraph.com. See you next time.